Did you ball on a budget? I guess that's the real
question.
No,
I did not.
Were you being drunk and alcohol?
No, I did not. I was not being drunk and alcohol. I'm sorry. Oh, this is me.
That's rough.
I know. I'm the one that tells everybody.
You know, that's the thing. It's even we're still practicing.
Yeah. Look, man, it's a thing that no one can get perfect at. You know, we say stage.
It's a dress rehearsal. No presentation's perfect. No,
yeah. None of them are. As a matter of fact, they're all probably the opposite of perfect.
They're all works in progress.
I mean, I don't think anybody's perfect at being drunk and alcohol. But we try our best, don't we?
Did you know that over $5 trillion exchanges hands on a daily basis? That's an average of over $220 billion an hour. Now, how does this much money move every single day, and why does it move the way it does? Here on Drunkenomics, two bartenders who also happen to be students at the University of Nebraska Graduate School of Business are going to sit down and drink to the global economy and try and translate it into English. So sit back, relax, pour yourself a stiff one, and have a drink with us to the comedy that is the global economy.
All right, everybody, welcome back to Drunkenomics. This is the drinking podcast, or should I say the drinking presentation with an economics problem. How y'all doing today? You solving your economics problem yet or no?
See, I'm not sure. So I like the idea that we're the drinking podcast with the economics problem. Welcome to our new presentation, because it's never an episode.
Yeah, welcome to the show.
Welcome back.
My name is Aaron. I am your. I think this week I'm more gracious than you. I'm sorry, man.
You should be.
You don't look very gracious.
I think last week you were too. To be fair,
was that really?
I'm wearing a Texas shirt. Oh, I think so.
I could have sworn I introduced myself as a less gracious host. So maybe I was lying. I don't know.
You did. It's just I really undercut you there in true less gracious host.
Wow,
form.
You really did not. Yeah, very less gracious
in
host form.
Least gracious host yes. form.
So. What was your name again, Mr. Least Gracious Host?
So I'm, of course, James Goldwater, right alongside my main man, Aaron Wong.
Yes. So let's get to it.
It's been an interesting week.
Yeah. If you haven't noticed, you know how we talk about five, or what did we say in that intro?
$5 trillion.
Dip. Well, what do we say in the intro? $5 trillion exchanges
trillion
hands.
Every
it
day?
Changes every single day, which I don't know. Maybe that's different now because I made that intro about a year ago and I just pretty much loop it in every single time. But
well, I was going to say it's definitely less than that now because I guess not so much today. But now look, guys, I'm from Florida. I'm all about going out with some buddies, jumping on the boat, taking some beers, having a good time.
Yeah.
When you block a canal like that, like I've been with some guys, like let's put it this way. I've been on some boats where I'm like, I should probably get off this boat. Like, I'm not driving, but this seems like a bad idea.
Yeah, my equilibrium.
Like, and not just me. I mean, like, even the driver, no one's in good shape. And it's just like, we should probably call. Hey, guys, let's call. Let's be responsible about this. But even we never got stuck in a canal.
And block 10% of global trade. So, you know, when we say $5 trillion exchanges hands, I mean.
I'm all about having a good time on a boat, but that's too much.
Yeah, I mean, so for the last, if you will, 4 or 5 days, it was more like $4.5 trillion for this exchange. And maybe, I mean, obviously,
well, yeah,
not that
I think,
concrete,
because they
you
said
know.
it was $400 million an hour.
Yeah, of cargo that got shipped through there. They said 10% of global trade. So if you think about
10%
it,
10% of the global,
trillion, so 5 trillion, 10% of 5 then, trillion, it's 500 yeah. billion.
And,
right?
and, it was, so. And it was $400 million an hour of global economic loss.
Yeah.
This is one of the things I read about. Just kind of did, and I decided, well, if it took all day Wednesday to all day Sunday, which,
right.
you know, the canal's not open yet because they have to make it usable
right,
again.
But they freed
the
ship.
Calculation
the ship
was
moved.
What? That was just $48 billion right off the top.
Right, off of the last 5 days.
Gone.
But granted, like, I mean, I don't know how much ships on the weekends, you know.
Well, not everyone's Amazon and the post office.
Yeah, exactly. So it's open now.
They refloated it and they've gotten it out of the way. They have to get the canal correct.
But, you know, it brings up questions, right? The markets didn't really panic. They did a little bit, but not as much as you. I mean, if 10% of global trade stops, you know, if 10% of your commerce completely stops, one way or another, it's going to affect you.
It should.
Yeah. I mean, not directly. And maybe it'll affect you a couple weeks from now. Maybe it'll affect you 6 months from now.
Yeah. And I don't know. Like I said, it's my view that there is mania in markets. And so
markets, I think, are just looking. They're looking for a reason to do something.
They're looking for a reason to go up. They are ignoring every reason to go down. Well, I guess that's not true. Last night, we did see news out of Europe and Japan that suggests, actually, there are some people who are looking and going, oh, yeah, no, that's bad.
Yeah.
That's bad.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like Istanbul. But, I mean, not that anyone cares about Istanbul stock market, but their stock market
Turkey's got
plummeted.
A very different problem. Turkey, so Erdogan has, President Erdogan of Turkey,
yeah.
He's fired his third central bank chairman in, I think it's 2 years.
Yeah.
No, so he's got a lot of problems. So yeah, his currency is devaluing.
But their current, the Turkish lira has been devaluing for a long time.
But now people have realized, like, people have boarded the ship in the Suez Canal, and they've realized, oh, there's no crew here. There was never a crew.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but like, when I saw that news about Istanbul's stock market, I was like, am I saying that right?
Istanbul.
Whatever. Istanbul.
Nope.
Right? Not very bullish. That's what I said.
Istanbul.
So when I saw that, I thought it was because of the Suez Canal. Obviously, they have bigger issues. I didn't know about the Fed, their Fed chairman getting.
Yeah, the third one in 2 years. Like, yeah.
Right. See, that's I mean, can you imagine if Jerome Powell got fired and then Janet Yellen got hired and then.
Imagine Janet Yellen got fired. And then imagine that Paul, not Paulson.
Bernanke? Powell?
Powell came in and Powell had run things for, or imagine Yellen ran it for about a year or a few months. And she gets fired. And then Powell comes in and he runs it for about 18 months and he gets fired. And they bring in a new guy. Let's say.
Let's say they bring in Mnuchin.
And Steve Mnuchin's like, I'm jumping ship.
6 months.
Chairman of the Fed. And he's like, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then like a year later, he's fired.
Yeah.
You would have no faith in the Federal Reserve, especially not its independence. You'd be like, and rightly so. You'd look and you go,
yeah.
Oh.
Well, there's no stability here.
Well, I would say the genius of the Federal Reserve System, in my opinion, in the United States, is the fact that while they are political appointees, with the exception of Janet Yellen, we can say that the vast majority of Fed leadership is independent of politics.
Of course.
They have a tenure.
I mean, you have to but
we hope.
You don't know.
If the system works perfectly, they're independent. They can make the right choices. Mm-hmm. Whereas a central bank, that is not the case.
Right.
You are exposed to those political forces.
Well,
and that's why you see this huge turnover. And whenever you see high turnover in a place, you know that whoever's in charge.
Well, yeah. So like, let's just say another analogy. So like, let's just say Goldman just hired and fired you know what I mean?
Just hiring and firing
CEOs.
Yeah.
So it went from like Lloyd to David Solomon to I don't know who else. And so it just kept like Goldman shares would plummet. So I think that's kind of what's happened with Istanbul.
Yeah, there's no leadership.
Istanbul, you know, so.
In Istanbul with the Istanbul.
Yeah. But like I said, but I thought it was a Suez Canal thing.
I'm sure that didn't help.
Of course not. But, you know, when it got stuck there, I mean, there were so many theories automatically, right? People were commenting on how fragile the global supply chain is, which I'm like, it's fragile. But I mean, like, no one really cared in the grand scheme of things, right? No, there was no panic anywhere. I mean, people were going like, oh, toilet paper shortage.
But remember, people in the U.S. didn't care that there was COVID in meatpacking plants until there were restrictions on how much meat they could buy.
Right.
You were warned a week ahead of time.
Yeah.
There's COVID in this plant in South Dakota, this plant in Nebraska. Yeah,
and these guys they produce 20%
of... No one cared. Then you get to the supermarket and it's maximum two.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, it's $15 a pound for 70/30. And it's like,
that's when people care.
Yeah.
People were told, hey, there's about to be a problem. And they went, and then the problem hit and they went, why didn't someone tell me?
Right.
And it's like, well, you just didn't understand.
Yeah. And they thought that the Suez Canal, like there were people saying that it's going to be done in a couple of days. And there are people saying that it's going to be there for months. And it's like, well, I mean, it's over now.
Well, it's
right?
not over.
They free floated.
They got the boat out of the
way. But I think the hard part is over. Right, getting the boat unstuck, I think, was the majority of the thing.
Yeah.
You know, they got the laxative,
refloating it and getting it out of the way.
Right.
Yeah. They've removed the blockage.
Yes. Exactly. So, you know, it sucks. I 10% of global trade being paused for
a business week.
Right. Exactly. No one likes it. But I do feel like, I mean, there were probably, you know, businesses that were trying to get things from one place to another. They've probably found alternate methods that were maybe a little bit more expensive.
Well,
but
yeah, you've got ships that are going around the horn.
Yeah.
On the plus side, if the ship is committed to that course, they're not going to turn around. I mean, let's put it this way. The canal's not open. Those ships that have decided to go around are going
round. They're not going back. So
they're not going to go back. They're not going to go back and sit in the Med or sit in in the Red Sea and wait for the canal to open. They're going to go around the horn and make their deliveries because a boat sitting somewhere is a boat not making money.
Well, it's actually losing a lot of money.
What I was going to say is, so if you are and my guess is there'll be a lot of, if you're a business person in Cape Town, in any kind of maritime industry, so refueling, repairs, that kind of thing, or the service industry that caters to mariners, hey boys, Get your game faces on. It's about to get real.
So like, and that's the thing is like, I don't think the global supply chain is that fragile. I just think they're trying to be lean, and because of that, they're still
everyone's trying to be efficient or lean.
Exactly.
I think what's happened is, does this affect like, obviously this affects costs. So, mm-hmm. you know, that's just going to happen.
For a period of time. But I mean, everything under the sun affects costs, man.
Well, yeah.
If it rained too many times. Yeah,
if the canal were to not exist, it would be problematic. Just like if the Panama Canal were to be made inoperable, that would be hugely damaging as well.
Yeah.
Does it suggest that perhaps having only one route is... let's put it this way. It has brought back into focus the fact that these two particular canals are very serious bottlenecks in the global supply chain.
Right. So I think for the most part, the economy is pretty adaptable in the sense that like they can find a way to recover from this. But I do think that there is a fragility aspect behind the fact that everybody is so reliant on this canal being functionable. Mm-hmm. And if something like this happened, it would suck. But nothing. I mean, there was no real effect as far as like, you know, it's not like prices of chicken went up overnight because
it's a delay. Right? It's a delay in shipping. About the only thing that I could see that was really going to be potentially affected was oil.
Yeah.
Was oil supplies.
Yeah, that makes sense.
The only reason it wouldn't affect things like liquid natural gas and things like that is that there's just so much of it. And it's fine. That even like the natural gas ships were just like the second they heard it was blocked, they all turned to go around. All went to go around the Cape and
we'll be 3 days late.
Right.
Sorry.
They just went, you know what? Our product is so inexpensive right now.
Yeah.
It'll be fine.
Yeah.
We'll be there.
So anyways, I don't know.
About where I'd finish out is there's I am well aware the cost is going to be massive, absolutely massive. Uh-huh. But at some point, someone is going to have to propose the idea, well, we have to make this more durable. You want it to be durable and pretty. So it's like one of those things where it's like, look, if it can't be pretty, it better be durable. So
yep.
It better never break.
Yep. But anyways, so that's that.
We did get a question.
Yes, we got to go to the question because it's from one of our patrons. Alex, I miss you too, man. It's about U.S. debt. U.S. foreign debt. So
it was a really interesting question because he's not the only person to have asked me that question. Mm-hmm. This question. I have another friend who asked me a really similar question. What he asked was, why don't two countries just forgive each other's debt? So like, if there were two countries that owed each other, you know, one owes one $100 billion, the other owes the other $70 billion. Why don't they just forgive $50 billion and call it even on that? Why don't they do it?
Well,
the answer to that's it's a little more complicated than it sounds.
Not that concrete. Yeah. So before we go on anymore, let's ask the question on air. So short version of his question, of Alex's question, is what conceivably happens if a country, say China, called on U.S. debt? He wants to know if it's going to be like mayhem or whatever and World War III, all that kind of stuff. I don't want to go down that rabbit hole.
That's a very extreme road. But I think it's a really cool question of why don't countries forgive each other's debt?
Yes.
Or what happens if, or why doesn't a country call another country?
So let's just start this. Who owns U.S. debt? Like, so who in China owns U.S. debt? When they say there's $800 billion of whatever.
So the first thing to me is that the single greatest owner of U.S. debt is in fact the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
So the U.S. owns its own debt, which is, it'll make more sense in a minute.
Right.
But who in China?
Uh-huh.
Sure. Some of it is owned by the Chinese government. Of course.
Of course. Governments borrow all the time with each other.
Vast majority of U.S. debt in China, so, is owned by businesses in China.
Mm-hmm. It's like the HSBCs of the world, right? They own a ton of
Shanghai Bank of Commerce.
A ton of U.S. bonds in their books. So if they decide to just call back the debt, I'll let you describe this. So if they call back the debt like that.
Well, so first off, the issue is, unless it's a callable bond,
mm-hmm.
so all debt that exists in the, almost all debt that exists in the world, the debt that we're talking about right now, it's all fixed income debt. It's all mm-hmm. bonds.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, yes, there are loans too, but that's not what we're talking about when we talk about this.
Yeah, they have purchased bonds 30 years, 20 years,
yes.
whatever. Every 6 months, they get this much cash flows from the bonds.
Most of this debt, so the debt we're talking about, unless the bonds are callable, you can't call on it. You have to wait till the term expires to get your principal back.
Or you can sell the bond to another investor.
Or you can sell it on the secondary market,
yep.
which is, so the primary market is when the issuer of the debt sells into the market for the first time.
You buy from the U.S. government directly when they issue those bonds.
Or the company when they issue those bonds.
Yeah.
If you're not buying from, if you're buying from anyone except the creator or issuer of the debt, you're on the secondary market.
Yeah.
The stock market is a secondary market. Right? So that's just to give you guys an idea there. So they can't call the debt. What they could do is they could dump it on the market. Now, what does that do to the U.S.? It would be extremely damaging. Of that, there is no doubt. It would probably collapse the world financial system.
No, it would without a doubt collapse. Not probably. It would without a doubt collapse.
Well, yes, I just didn't want to say that.
Well, I just did. So
the problem is, and so here's the problem: if you are anyone else on Earth, the global financial system just collapsed because of something you did. On what planet, because it's clearly not this one, is that a good idea?
Yeah, so if China calls it back.
Right, so China can't call it back is the first thing.
If they did, dumped it
on the market.
Like what James said, and what I reiterated, is it would collapse the world financial system. That would just be a terrible idea. But let's just say that was in their interest.
What, because China is in the world?
Yeah.
So the thing is, if China sells all their U.S. securities, say it's just the Chinese government, just puts all their securities on the market immediately.
What would happen to the value of the bonds?
It collapses the U.S. economy. It collapses the value of those bonds. Mm-hmm. So the first thing is, if they actually get to fill every order. By the way, folks, if you're listening right now, feel free to fill and kill. they're going to be making pennies on the dollar at best. So the first thing out the gate, if China calls the debt, is they lose a huge amount of money. Mm-hmm. The second is, in doing that, they collapse the economy. The
world economy.
Of their biggest customer. Yeah. Of their biggest customer.
Yeah, by far.
So You could do it, but it's like setting the fire station on fire and then running around with Molotov cocktails.
There's your spirits analogy. Now I got to take a sip.
I don't even know if that works. It's like being the fireman.
Another analogy?
It's like being It's being the sole firefighter in town who runs around with Molotov cocktails and then finds himself overworked and out of business.
Yeah.
Because people saw you doing it.
Well, this is the thing. So like, it's not the Chinese government that owns U.S. debt, right? The securitized debt.
The vast majority of it's Chinese businesses.
Of course, yeah. It's banks like HSBC. First of all, it's a business. Huh. They're out to make a profit.
So if they were to dump everything, the first thing they're not going to do.
Yeah, one, they're getting pennies on the dollar. Their balance sheets would just be completely lopsided.
It should huge losses.
Yeah,
huge
losses. Insane. But and we, the U.S., owns a lot of Chinese debt too. Mm-hmm. So now
we definitely can't pay.
Yeah, so now we can't pay back the funds that they have already given us because we borrowed money from them. So now we can't pay that back. So it's not just like the U.S. government would look like really terrible debtors, but it'd also be like the businesses would be losing so much money. Like HSBC would go under easily.
Would have to.
And then not even them, it'd be like Nike and all these companies that.
Well, now they're not making shoes in China. So now China's going, well, we just thought we were trying to break the U.S. economy. I can't believe that destroying the people that manufacture things here would cause all the people in the factories to now be unemployed. It's like, it's one of those things you look at, it's kind of like, if there was an arsonist who really wanted to burn the world down, that'd be a great way to do it.
Yeah.
But
there you go.
But it's one of those mutually assured destruction things where it's like, it's for everything that hits you, I'm also shooting at myself. It's a bad idea.
Yeah.
This is a multi-part question.
Yeah.
And I actually, Aaron, I want to ask you the second part.
Oh, okay.
So is there a conceivable time period in which a country might have made enough inroads into other countries to offset wanting to trade with the U.S. or dissolution of their partnership with the U.S. market and the U.S. economy as a whole?
But why would you not want to do business with the U.S.?
Well, my thing is like, why would you not want to do business with anyone? The U.S. is 25% of the world's economy. I could do business with 75% of the world, or I can do business with 100% of the world, right? I'll sell anything to anyone. I don't care. Within reason. Obviously, there's limits on that.
So that's my thing. Is just like, there are so many things that the U.S. just does better than other parts of the world. And it's not like, I don't know. Like, why would you not want access to 25% of the entire global economy? Why would you not want to do business with them? So that's really my response to that.
Oh, yeah. No, I would do it. If there's like 50 people in a room and one of them has got a quarter of the money and it's like, you could do business with the other 49, I'd be like, why can't I do business with all 50?
Yeah.
Yeah. So my view is it possible that you might find yourself at a point where you can offset the loss by picking up other markets?
Yep.
Yeah, you could. But at the same time, I would say it's just better to pick up the other markets as well.
Yeah, I'm not saying that, I don't think every country in the world does do business with the U.S. Maybe I think they do, but I don't know for sure, right?
No, Cuba probably doesn't.
Right.
Well, we embargoed them,
So that just sucks for Cuba, but I'm just saying,
not really. They do business with everyone else,
right? But
it would be better for them economically if they did business with the U.S. But it also, I so mean, that's what, it's I mean, a matter of principle, I guess. Fuck it.
Yeah, I mean, who cares? So that's my response to that. I mean, I have no idea what to say aside from, I mean, they could, I'm sure they would manage. They'd figure out a way. I mean, like, I think people around the world are just resilient enough where they'll find a way to put food on the table.
Well, the great thing in the U.S. is that we're a net producer of food. So like the big issue is like, would quality of life go down in the U.S.? It's possible. But as a whole, about the only thing in a legitimate stop in business between China and the United States would do is that suddenly inferior goods would become more expensive.
Right.
The term inferior goods is using the economic term, which is to say inexpensive goods generally of a lower quality. There's right, no, yeah. That's about, that's that, and that's, that is
like
the
your fake Rolex.
Meaning, my Frolex?
Mm-hmm.
My Fomiga?
You got it. Anyways, I want to move on because I want to talk about swaps here pretty soon. Because mm-hmm. I think there is a pretty large issue that happened on Friday and kind of crept into the news today. But Alex, hope that answers your question. If not, heckle us.
There was that third point. There was the point you asked about World War III. And all I'll say about World War III is Cicero said that the sinews of war are infinite money. And in the situation where debt's getting called like that, there is no money. So, you know, that's where I'll land
on
that.
But like I said, if that doesn't answer your question or if you have more questions,
you know where to find me. You know my days.
Yeah, you know when James works at Cigars Lounge, so go bother him.
Don't say bother, just say go give James shit.
Yeah, there you
give
go.
Give him shit about it. Yeah. Shitty answer, man.
Criticize us.
Feel free. That's forever. That's an open
call. That's literally anybody. If we said something that you're like, hey, what was that? Let us know.
Oh, yeah. By the way, to Tim, my Australian accent is absolutely atrocious.
What is wrong with you?
What are you talking about?
Oi. Oh, that's more of an Irish thing, isn't it?
I don't know what that one. I don't know what it
whatever.
Was.
Anyways, moving into swaps. All right, we're swapping into this part of the, presentation
we're
now.
Out.
So if you've been living under a rock, I want to lift the rock and let you know that there was a hedge fund out there. What is the name of the hedge
Tregos,
fund?
Archegos.
Whatever. So they were really, really overleveraged into, it looked like, I think they were really overleveraged into Viacom and Discovery, which are two really, really good.
And some Chinese companies as well.
Yeah, and some Chinese companies like Tencent, Baidu, and all those companies.
Yeah.
So they're really overleveraged into those positions. And the reason why is because I think there was just a giant lack of transparency between them and their prime broker, which I think their prime broker was Goldman Sachs. And Goldman Sachs, I think Wells Fargo. And I'm not exactly sure how hedge funds work, but they have a prime brokerage in, you know, an investment bank will offer a prime brokerage service. So that basically you buy services from guys like Goldman Sachs.
I come to you first. You're my guy.
Yeah.
That's how the prime works.
Right. Exactly. So, I mean, and so prime brokerages are mainly, they're mainly geared towards hedge funds. Mm-hmm. They offer them a bunch of different services. I'm not exactly sure what all entails, but basically one of the services that they offer is that they hold the securities that the hedge fund buys. They hold it in street name at the prime brokerage.
Yeah.
Right?
It's they'll do a lot of the purchasing. They'll take a lot of the, so the hedge stays out of it. So the hedge fund will stay out of it.
Yeah.
So it's not like, oh, Pershing Square is blah, 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 blah. And so eventually Pershing will disclose what they're doing.
Right.
But when purchases happen and when certain activities, it's not being done by me, it's being done by my prime.
Right.
So it gets lost in a bunch of other trades.
And so one of the things that they offer is one, they hold the securities in street name for the hedge fund. What does that mean? Mm-hmm. Basically, so if you open up an account with E-Trade or TD Ameritrade and you bought Apple, like, yeah, you own the shares. If Apple ever goes bankrupt, you're entitled to whatever the shares entitle you to upon bankruptcy or whatever. I mean, not that they're ever going to go bankrupt, but I'm just, for an example.
Entitled to what's left after
the debts,
is paid.
After taxes, debts, right, all and preferred shareholders.
Yep, common shareholder, you are the last in line.
Yeah, exactly. So like the brokerage firm, technically, they hold the stock, they hold it in their account, but it's in your account within their giant account, right?
Yeah.
In street name is kind of a weird thing. Basically, the stock belongs to you, but it's held by the broker. So Goldman Sachs held Discovery, Viacom, all these different companies in street name for Archegos, whatever the name of that
hedge
fund is.
The funny thing is, on top of that, it's actually a family office.
It is technically it's family office, right? But a lot of hedge funds are family offices.
Yeah.
Right.
So hedge fund is a behavior, is more behavior than anything else.
Yeah.
I know we haven't fully defined what a hedge fund is or what they do. We'll talk about, we're still working on like how to give you the best idea of that possible.
Right.
But the easiest way to just think of a hedge fund is it's a pool of wealthy people's money. And then the fund is actively managed and it takes extreme risks to get big returns. So big risks, big returns.
And they lever as much. Yeah. They lever they up lever as, much, up as, they
as
can.
Much as they can.
Yeah.
Now, a family office, if you guys are wondering what a family office is, it is money. They do not have outside investment. It is closed and no external money. So no money from banks, no money from any other fund. Only people that work there that are partners there can put their money in.
Right.
That's essentially what a family office is.
So what happens when you buy a stock and like you open up a Robinhood account and you buy stock off Robinhood. Like Robinhood, the name of the stock is in Robinhood, but it's owned by you, right? It's owned by the person that purchased the stock, obviously.
Yes.
Why would it be in Robinhood's name? Because these stocks trade all the time. So it's like,
I guess the easiest for me to say is until you have like a big block of shares,
right?
And if you're a hedge fund, you have a big block of shares, you keep it in your broker's name.
Yeah.
Because it's more important to know that the broker has 500 shares than it is to know that Tim has one and Sally has one and Clarence has one. I'm not talking to them.
Another reason why street name is important is because, you know, it makes it easy for the broker. Like if you're going to purchase securities on margin, they're technically not owned by you. They're like, they're in your account, but they're not owned by you.
Because you borrowed money to buy.
Right. And I'm bringing this up for a reason. I'll get there. But the other thing is too, like you can buy securities in your account and the broker, you can say these securities are loanable. So if someone wanted to short the stocks in your account, they can borrow it from you. Short it, and then you know, and if you call back the short, then they have to give it back to you, right? So, you know, it's easier for that to happen if the securities are held in street name. I hope you're following along with me, but if you're not, I'm sorry. Feel free to ask us any questions in our Discord or whatever. But the reason why I bring this up is because what happened on Friday was, if anybody's been paying attention to Viacom and Discovery, first of all, Viacom and Discovery are both very, very good companies.
I agree.
Yeah. And their stock has been on a run for quite some time.
I think Viacom CBS is producing some very good entertainment right now.
So right. As far as how valuable that entertainment is, I don't know. Right. And I'm not saying everybody should buy Viacom right now because that's not true. Right. This is not investment advice, but
clearly,
yeah, their stock went from like $25 to $100 in a very short period of time. And it was very recent. I don't know exactly the time frame in which that happened, but when it happened, a firm like Archegos levered up like you wouldn't believe.
Bought on margin.
3-4 times leverage.
They went big.
They kept buying into Viacom, CBS, Discovery, and all that kind of stuff.
Now, they did it. Let's be fair. They did it through swaps.
They did do it through swaps, which I want to talk about.
Which is what we're going
to
talk about.
They ran the stock all the way up to 100-something bucks. And the CEO of Viacom came out when the stock was at around $100, and he did what a lot of people do when the stock is at $100 a share, or when the stock recently goes on a run like that. He goes, I'm going to do another share offering, right? I'm going to raise more money, especially right now when I can get it for 17 times PE, or I don't know what the PE ratio
when I can issue very few shares to get the capital I want to get.
Exactly. So he announced that stock offering, and what happened to Viacom when they announced that offering? Their stock went from 100 to 50 in a hurry. And today it was around 40 something bucks a share. I don't even remember, but it dropped from $100 in a week.
I know they plan to buy in a weekend.
Yeah.
Or they plan to issue $3 billion in shares.
Exactly.
I think that's what that was.
Yeah.
And that imploded. Were they using, was it Morgan Stanley or JP Morgan?
I don't know who
they
were.
Which of the Morgans were they with?
I can't remember.
Oh, it was Morgan Stanley and JP
Morgan.
It wasn't which one. It was both the Morgans.
So that was your confusion.
That's why I was sitting here like, which one was it? No, it was both.
Yeah.
They were going to do $3 billion between the two of them. It cratered.
Yeah, but that's what happens when you announce an offering. That's what happens when you announce
It is what can happen when you announce an offering.
Usually
yes. If we assume the markets are supply and demand, and suddenly there's going to be a bigger supply,
yes,
even if demand's the same, price goes down.
Well, I mean, scarcity. You're looking at it way too rationally.
How dare I?
Yeah, I know.
That's clearly the drunkenomical approach to markets right now, because no one else is.
Yeah, well, I guess
Friday maybe more people were, but no one else is.
I mean, but Viacom and Discover are both very good companies. Their stock went on a run a little bit. I think the acceleration wasn't called for, but they're good companies, right? So what happened with Archegos, like I said, was they kept buying and they kept borrowing money from Goldman and whoever else it was to load up on more shares. And then when it tanked, there was a margin call and they couldn't meet it.
And so when you cannot meet or don't, I guess there's possibilities where you could, but you just choose not to. I don't know why you would.
Yeah.
If you cannot make good at the margin call, your prime or primes, theoretically you may have primes.
But they had more than one.
Yep,
they did have more than one.
Then have to sell off your position to cover.
Yeah. And this is the thing too. So like in a regular margin account, if you buy shares of a certain company and those share prices go up, then the broker that let you have a margin account, they're going to loan you more money. Your buying power is going to go up. And that's essentially what happened with Archegos, was as Viacom kept appreciating in value, they were able to borrow more money. So they kept levering up and loading into these shares. And how do they collateralize the margin? The way they collateralize the margin is, you know, the shares that you have purchased on margin, that's your collateral. And then the rest of your account is also, I guess, technically part of the collateral, because they want their money back. So the equity value of their portfolio went down. Goldman issued a margin call.
So margin call is just, hey, you need to give us some cash.
To cover the margin balance.
To cover this balance. Like, you need to give us some cash. And that's it. So it's like a margin call could be $50. It's like, hey, look.
Because you got to meet an equity requirement.
Yeah, there's an equity requirement.
Yeah. And it's set by FINRA. So that's what happened. But like when you lever up four times and you buy stocks that go up and then it drops half in value, you can't make your margin call. There's no way. And there's some sort of disclosure that you have to have. And I forget exactly what it is, but if you own more than 10% of a certain company, I forget the actual legal term, but you're like, basically the SEC rule is if you're an officer, director, or if you own 10% of the shares, there's a certain rule. You're in a class of a different kind of investor. But the difference was Archegos owned 50%, I think, of Viacom. And they're all being held in street name at Goldman.
So, okay, I looked at it. It's 5% and you're a beneficial owner.
Oh, well, no, but there's a different level if you're at 10%. But first of all, they're being held in street name at Goldman. And not to mention 75% of that was purchased on margin.
It's very silly and it's stupid that we both forgot it.
Yeah. Oh,
once you own 10% of a firm, you are an insider.
That is, oh my
god. It's Section 16. You're an insider.
It's SEC, right? It's an SEC rule.
SEC rule. So you have to file under Section 16 and you are an insider.
Yeah,
when you own 10% of a company, of course you're an insider. You can demand of management what is happening in this.
Yeah. Firm. So, and can you own 10% of a certain company in street name? I don't know.
If it all comes back to you, my understanding is Section 16 then qualifies you as an insider.
Sure.
You have to disclose your position.
Well, there's a lack of disclosure. And not to mention like 75% of it was purchased on margin, right? I mean, Goldman lent the Bill Huang from Archegos. Bill Huang, whatever. What is Huang with him? But yeah, so what was the thing about swaps? There's something about swaps. The news was they're going to restructure the way, or the government is interested, or at least inquiring about restructuring the way swaps and swap derivatives work.
Yeah, well, so the issue with swaps in that respect is that because of the fact that swaps are specific, are almost always very specific to whoever is trying to create the swap, is that swaps are done over the counter.
Yeah, they're agreements between two people.
Between two parties.
So
it's done over the counter, but one of the big things with swaps is that you don't have to disclose your position.
Oh,
I'm sorry.
Was that?
It's not their positions. They don't have to disclose their holdings, which I would argue is the same thing, but it's possible that I'm not correct in that. But when you issue a swap, you don't have to disclose your holdings. So you can.
Yeah. So in terms of how this worked with Archegos, do you know how that played out? Because like usually swaps, the way I rationalize swaps is like if there's an interest rate on debt, if there's a floating interest rate, you create a swap agreement
with someone
else, Goldman Sachs, and they make your rate a steady going rate and they pay off your actual floating rate. Right, you pay them a steady fixed rate.
And they take from you, and then they sell less than that to someone else.
Yeah, so hopefully for the investment bank or whoever made the swap agreement with
you, they make money.
Yeah, hopefully they make money. I mean, that's the point.
They make an agreement that, oh, you're 5-9% variable rate, and then they turn around and they say they're going to give 6% to anyone else.
Yeah.
Hopefully, more often than not, you're above that 6% so they can profit. I mean, if you only deliver 5% and they've agreed to 6, they're going to have to pay out of pocket.
Yeah, it sucks for them. But how it played into this whole Archegos thing? Was it like a margin interest rate agreement?
So what I've read, he used swaps to take the equity.
Oh, he did?
Or the gain on equity.
Wait, so Archegos was selling swaps or was...
Archegos was using swaps to acquire Viacom, CBS, Discovery, all these guys. So that's how they were doing it. Uh-huh. And then when the intent to release more stock was announced, caused the share prices to plummet. And that caused Morgan Stanley and JP Morgan were working for Viacom, CBS.
Yeah.
But then it was at Goldman and...
I think it was Wells Fargo or
Goldman, Morgan Stanley... Deutsche.
Yeah, I know Deutsche was in there too.
We're all involved and they've all come out. Well, Deutsche said they had de-risked their exposure to Archegos. Goldman has not replied as of today.
Yeah.
One can assume though that Nomura, which is a Japanese, and Credit Suisse both were unable to avoid that downside exposure. The bank, Nomura has said, we have lost $2 billion. In the force exposure.
Yeah, exactly.
Credit Suisse, which was down 15% apparently following the announcement, I think they closed down about 12. They did not disclose a dollar value. All they said was it was a highly material loss.
Right.
For me, the interesting thing is the difference between material and highly material. If material is $2 billion now, and these are two different firms, material. How much are they in this for?
Yeah.
I guess the reason I bring up materiality or the reason I go to this material statement is it's a phrase that gets used a lot in accounting is this is a material issue. Uh-huh. 10 cents a sheet of printed paper is not material for $1 billion firm,
right?
But a $50 million loss might be. $500 million loss.
One of the things that kind of distinguishes material and I guess non-material would be like if you held a position and the price of that position plummets and you haven't realized it yet, is that technically material or non-material? Or if it's just appreciation?
Well,
right?
So it's
depreciation technically material or non-material?
It can be. You know what I mean? It all depends. There's a few different like static metrics and then there's a few different like moving metrics that can get used. They get used in accounting. The big ones I look at are it's material if it's 5% of pre-tax revenue.
Oh, wow.
Or more. It is material if it is greater than 1% of after-tax profits. Mm-hmm. It's clearly material if it turns profit to loss.
Right.
I mean, it's also material if it turns a loss into a gain. It's material information.
Right.
The easiest way to describe materiality, if it's something that would be expected to influence
whether or not you want to invest, right?
An external consumer of the information, if it would affect them if a reasonable shareholder would change their decision based on this,
yeah.
It is material.
Or if it's one of the factors that they would consider when it comes to buying into a certain company.
Well, no. Right? Or if it's going to change, if it's going to, if it would cause them to change their mind or reconsider, right. Then it is material. So it's like, if it's $1 billion of revenue and we're talking about $100, that is not material. If it is $1 billion of revenue and we're talking about $5 million, it's probably still not material. But if it's $1 billion revenue, we're talking about $100 million. That's material.
Yeah. So
that is material.
In terms of Archegos, I mean,
well, with Archegos, it was $20 billion.
Right. It says a $20 billion hedge fund or a $30 billion hedge fund. And when they personally, like their own equity, when they lose $2 billion on a trade, not to mention they're in a margin call for pretty much
$20 billion loss on a margin.
Yeah. The margin call was over $20 billion, right?
Oh yeah, but the loss was $20 billion.
Okay. I thought the margin call was $20 billion. But I don't know. I didn't look into it that much because I didn't really pay attention to the news today. I was pretty much hungover all day. But thank you. I appreciate it. But
the sale was $20 billion.
Yeah.
$20 billion was liquidated. Was liquidated to cover. I mean, the hedge fund's out $20 billion. That's easy. Let's put it that way. They're out $20 billion.
So if they liquidated $20 billion to cover the loss, I mean, that means the loss is probably greater, especially if when a company loses half its value and you went 4x leverage on that. You lost more than you had in the fund or in the position, if you will.
Yeah, see, not necessarily in the fund.
Right. Yeah. So I don't know. I'm still trying to figure out how the swap agreements worked in that whole thing. I mean, I remember listening to David Faber this morning saying like,
okay, you know, so there's going to be a way they restructure. I think I know what he was doing. He was probably doing a total return swap.
Oh, okay.
He swapped in exchange for a fixed interest rate with someone who actually had it. And he said, I'll give you a fixed interest rate, assuming the value will go up. So you can pay a fixed interest rate to one party in return for all the capital appreciation plus dividend payments of a pool or of a stock.
Oh,
so that's okay. What I think he must have done.
So he did that with Goldman?
Goldman did that with him? No, because he was exposed to the price drop, not Goldman.
Yeah.
So he probably said, look, I'll pay you interest if you just let me just get me in there. Yeah. And then he got in there. And then they said, hey, and then ComCBS said, hey, we want $3 billion, or we're going to offer $3 billion in shares. And then everyone else went, nope. And everything he'd ratcheted on the way up suddenly plummeted. And the banks were like, oh, we need to deal with this.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So like, I feel like that makes sense. And I just, like, to me, it's just like, I don't understand how he found his way into such a massive position in all of these companies without anybody none of these prime brokers knew anything.
Well, remember when you're using swaps to do it. So he was buying stock. I don't deny he was definitely buying stock, but he was also using swaps. And in his swaps, he doesn't have to disclose his holdings. Right. So that's how they don't know.
So do you think, and not to mention he had more than one prime broker.
If there's going to be a reform on this.
I think there will be. I'm almost certain there will be.
What you'll probably see is that swaps will become more heavily regulated or regulated at all. There'll be a point where he just goes, you know what? It's a great point in margin call the movie. They're sitting here doing all these swaps and they're sitting there saying, well, what are you doing? Where does this land? It's like, well, do you really care? No. Everyone else on the street is realizing what's happening because what they're hearing is like, well, look, you guys are dumping everything. What the hell's going on? But at no point do they have to disclose, yeah, I'm swapping this because blah, we're taking a net short position or something.
You know, when 10% of a company or 15% of a company gets liquidated, or not liquidated, but sold that quickly, I mean, that explains such a massive acceleration towards the downside that we saw in all these companies that they were holding. I mean,
right, so some of these were the companies being held and being swapped for, and some of these were the guys who were the counterparties on the swaps.
So I do I'm almost certain that there's going to be a reform. I think the government is going to come down on swaps. There's going to be a transparency that you just have to.
Yeah.
There's no way.
You have to.
Right.
It's gotten to a point now where you can't have. It's kind of blind trading. It's kind of blind swapping. Right. And in the end, what you'll probably see is this might actually be driven by the banks because a few of them are going to sit here and go like, well, some have lost a lot of money and barely didn't.
Yeah. So like, that's what I'm saying. Like if the banks want something to happen, the odds of it happening are going to be a lot higher or just going to be way higher. Yeah. So,
well, it's going to be one of those things where are they going to sit here and go like, oh, we should improve our internal controls. And other than that, fuck it. Or are they going to actually sit here and look at this and go like, wow, no, 20 to 30 billion was too much in a single day with a single fund. You know, that's right. It'll be interesting to see.
I just finished my bottle of Michter's.
Oh, no.
So, but I mean, I don't know. Hopefully this enlightened you on what swaps are, what prime brokerages are, and what being held in street name and margin accounts are. I don't know. What are your final thoughts on swaps?
I think they're going to have to get regulated at some point because that's going to happen is you're going to see eventually all the guys who you're going to see them turn around and start trying to do swaps with retail investors. And if you don't have to disclose your holdings, the retail investor simply does not know.
Yeah, and that's the thing is like literally the SEC and FINRA, like their whole premise is transparency, right? Like tax documents, all that kind of stuff. Their whole thing, their mantra is transparency. And the fact that you don't have to disclose any sort of transparency with swaps and you can load up.
Yeah, with any of your swaps. Yeah,
you can load up
to a $20 to $30 billion fire sale.
It's not even that. It's you own 15% of a company. It's held in street name in your name at your prime brokerage.
Absolutely.
I think there's got to be some sort of reform. Oh, that's what happens when I'm out of Michter's. I just can't talk right. But anyways, that about does her for this presentation. I'm just going to say hi to my professor on my way out. Also, I would like to mention that we do have this thing called merchandise. You should check it out. It's called shop.spreadshirt.com/drunkenomics. James has a pretty cool hoodie. I have a pretty cool hoodie.
Yeah. Finn has a sweet bandana.
He looks so handsome in that thing.
Good looking dog.
Great looking dog. Check that out. Additionally, find us on social media at Drunkonomical. DRUNKOMICAL.
All right. And that is Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. And many of those, you can find access to our Discord. Please join the Discord.
Please join
the
Discord.
We actually had some pretty good joining this week. We had, I think, about three or four people come in. That was pretty sweet.
And just good interactions. And Tim talking about how our Australian accents suck.
Oh, yeah.
Come on, man.
They are bad. Yeah. They're demonstrably bad. Yeah. It's because we're not.
At least we beat a Tarantino, so.
Barely. I'm sure it's barely.
It's marginal. Yeah, I get it, man. I know, it's slim. But from there, we also have Patreon. patreon.com/drunkonomics. If you feel bad for me because I ran out of Michters this episode,
or just want to help us keep the lights on the liquor cabinet stocked,
feel free to, you know, be generous there. I appreciate everything you guys do. Do we say everything else we need to say? Chestnut Checkers, Fill and Kill.
Wait a minute.
A minute?
Don't be like that guy in the Suez Canal. Stay drunkonomical.
Cheers, my friend.
A Huda Media Production.